Okay, so I will talk about transport coefficients and spectral functions from the lattice. And this is recent work I did with another postdoc at OSU, José María Martínez Resco. And then in the last part of the talk, I will talk about some older work I did. So let me start with the outline of the talk. First, I will spend some words on why transport coefficients are interesting for Rick and in general. And then go to the relation between spectral functions and lattice correlators. And spend most of the time on the example of the shear viscosity, both in the scalar theory and in the gauge theory. And then it turns out that the findings we get are also relevant for other problems, and in particular for this problem of the thermodilaton rate, which Kash talked about here at the conference. And after that, I will change a little bit and discuss the classical field approximation and see if we can also say something there about spectral functions. And I will give an example of the plasmon in the classical field theory. So transport coefficients in general are somehow interesting. For Rick, they could be interesting as they appear in non-ideal hydrodynamics. But it seems to be that ideal hydrodynamics works very well. So the question if it's really necessary to include it is not obvious to me. From just a field theory point of view, it's interesting because it turns out that the calculation of transport coefficients is highly non-trivial. And you can see this if you look at what actually has been computed using field theory, so that it's using Kubel relations and diagrams. It turns out that almost nothing has been computed completely satisfactory. So the famous example is the shear viscosity by Jian. Where you have to sum a whole class of diagrams. So this is a one-loop diagram here, and then the whole class of ladder diagrams. And then to be precise, you go to zero spatial momentum, and the external frequency is taken to zero, and it's the imaginary part of this class of diagrams. And in gauge theories, it turns out that only one quantity has been calculated in this language, which is the color conductivity. And this has been calculated by my collaborator in his PhD thesis. And in this case, you have the same structure. You have one gluon diagram and one loop quark diagram, and then a whole series of ladder diagrams with soft gluons on the rungs. All the other transport coefficients in a gauge theory, such as viscosities, electroconductivity, and flavor diffusion, have only been calculated in kinetic theory, and only recently to full satisfaction, according to these authors, at least. And this calculation is also only to leading log accuracy. So somehow it seems to be very.
The calculations above are leading order in the coupling constant?
These are also leading log.
Well,
in the scalar case, I guess it's completely leading order. But in the color conductivity, it's also a leading log calculation. And in the color conductivity, it has been calculated to full expansion by Arnold Moore and Jaffe, I think, using kinetic theory. So somehow you would like to see if it's possible to calculate transport coefficients completely non-perturbative using lattice QCD. This seems to be important thing if it's possible. And it turns out that there was a first attempt in the 80s by Kash and Wout, and then it somehow there's only one paper, and then it somehow stopped. And then the Japanese group basically continued this work basically from 96 till present, following exactly the same approach as Kash and Wout did. So I will explain what they did. Well, basically they start from the Kubel relation. So if you look for the shear viscosity, you can define the shear viscosity as follows, as the expectation value of the commutator of the energy momentum tensor, and it's actually the traceless part of the energy momentum tensor, and then taken at zero spatial momentum and in the limit of very small frequencies. You can rewrite this a little bit by introducing the notation of a spectral function. In general, spectral functions are commutators of quantities, or if you go in Fourier space, they are imaginary parts of retarded Green's functions. So this is the general definition of the spectral function. And then if you look at it, the shear viscosity is actually the slope of the spectral function at zero frequency. Now, the spectral function is odd and positive for positive frequency. So you know that it will look something like this around zero frequency. And you're interested just in the slope of this quantity. But the spectral function is a real-time correlator. And on the lattice, you can only calculate Euclidean time correlators. So there is, of course, a relation with the Euclidean correlator. So if I go to imaginary time, where time is compactified and decomposed in Matsubara frequencies, the spectral function and the lattice correlator are related by a dispersion relation. It's given above. And then going back to the imaginary time, you end up with an integral equation of this form. So here's the lattice correlator as a function of imaginary time. There is a kernel here, which comes from doing the Matsubara sum. This kernel can actually be written in an infinite number of ways. But I found this a convenient way because it shows it's basically the propagation in imaginary time multiplied with the occupation numbers, which you recognize from KMS condition, for instance, and then times the spectral function. So on the lattice, the program would be as follows. Sorry. You calculate the Euclidean correlator numerically, and then try to reconstruct this spectral function from this integral equation. And you can do this. You can try to attack this problem in different ways. And Kash and Wao propose to use an ansatz for the spectral function, and then fit this ansatz to the result for the Euclidean correlator. A more modern way would probably be to use the maximal entropy method to try to reconstruct the spectral function. It's an inverse problem, yeah. That's right. Yeah. An ill post, yeah. But according to the slogans, the maximal entropy method is very good for ill post problems. So, and then once you have constructed this, you can. Once you have constructed the whole spectral function, you can then go to very small frequencies and look at the slope. Now, there are some obvious questions which maybe surprisingly I could not find in the literature. These people introduced some ansatz basically out of the hat, and the question is, what does the spectral function actually look like at very high temperature? And then a simpler question is even, what does the Euclidean correlator look like? And the most important question actually is, how does the viscosity, or in more general, the spectral function at very small frequencies manifest itself in the Euclidean correlator? So what is the distinct feature in the Euclidean correlator from which you can tell something about the viscosity?
The K up in that integral equation, that's exact, right?
That's exact, yeah. That's exact.
In general,
right.
And you constructed a function maybe everywhere.
Yeah.
Then it wouldn't be very sensitive to that one point because this is an integral.
Yeah. That is actually precisely the point which I come to in the next transparency, that it turns out that it's very difficult to reconstruct especially this point at zero frequency, because you might be able to reconstruct the global shape at higher frequencies, but this specific point at small frequencies is...
You need an infinite lattice to go to,
No, even
so
if...
Much tau means small omega. So if you want small omega, you want to measure it
much deeper. I don't... So you even if you say you would have an infinite number of lattice points in the time direction, you still have compactified time. So that doesn't help. Even with infinite points in the time direction, it doesn't solve it. Yeah. So the problem is more severe than just scaling up your lattice, basically. So actually, this the influence of this very small frequency region is very easy to estimate. If you go back to this...
Wait, so can you say the problem has, we want small omega, which naively suggests we want large tau, but we don't have large tau?
No, I don't think that's the problem.
That's not the problem.
Because by definition, tau is constrained between 0 and 1 over t. And that is, so tau cannot be larger, and there is no larger tau in the problem.
Right, right. But so given that tau is constrained, how do you extract small omega? That's the...
It's unrelated.
Yeah. It's so it's very difficult, but it's not related to that problem. Actually, so you can see here why it's difficult. If you are interested only in very small frequencies, and let's put a cutoff here so we can look at the small frequencies here. You can expand the kernel, and the Bose distributions. If you expand them to lowest order, you get the classical T over omega, and then there are higher order terms, and it turns out that this leading term here is tau independent, and all the tau dependence resides in these higher order terms. This means that if I'm only interested in the very low frequency part of the spectral function, it just contributes a constant, a tau independent constant to the Euclidean correlator. It's not only a constant, so it does not depend on tau, but it's only not determined by rho itself, but it's determined by the integral of rho over omega. So this is the problem basically, and this is a completely generic feature that the whole low frequency region, where all the interesting stuff about the soft dynamics sits, and where the information or transport coefficient sits, comes back in the Euclidean correlator just as a single constant, and it reflects not rho, but it reflects an integral over rho, and this is the basic difficulty.
So you say that the tau dependence cannot be used to access
right.
the frequency limit at all.
Yeah.
And the low frequency limit is hidden in an integral. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I should say I don't solve this problem. So you might think now that in the rest of the hour I solve it. But
this problem is simply unsolvable.
Yeah, I think in general this is an unsolvable problem. Yeah.
It's not solvable by this time.
So the usual thing, if you have infinitely good data, then perfectly well posed problem.
No, but if you have infinitely good data, you get some very well determined constant contribution to the Euclidean correlator, which tells you something about this integral over rho. So you might know this particular integral very well. But from okay, so if you have analytically, it's perfectly well posed. I mean, you can just do your analytic continuation. Yes, yeah. I mean, if you do it by hand, you can.
Yeah. So the statement about the problem of principle is that from here, all you learn is this integral, and so then you have to go and learn many, many other things about rho going away from the
small frequency.
Limit. You have to learn all kinds. You have to get away from the small frequency limit, learn all kinds of other things about rho,
and then try to use that information.
Extract the one thing that you actually do know.
Yeah.
So the point is, you can't. The one thing you're interested in is a small omega thing. But to learn it, you have to get
right.
You have to do all kinds of things that aren't small omega.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
makes sense because it's.
So actually, that is the approach I will go through in the rest of the talk. Try to calculate the spectral function in the best way as you can for all frequencies, and then propose a kind of a fit for this general form of the spectral function, and then see how far you would be able to get there.
By the way, the fact that small omega corresponds to a constant in the Euclidean correlator, can I just understand that just in terms of, I have only a finite extent in tau? And if I want small omega, suppose I had infinite tau, that would be a very, very long wavelength in tau. And I only have a small slab of tau, so it'll look like a constant.
I'm not sure if you can look at it like that, because this long wavelength is in time, is in real time.
Right.
So if you talk about infinite time, you talk about infinite real time.
Yeah.
And if you talk about constant in Euclidean time, you talk basically about the zero Matsubara frequency. But you're not interested in the zero Matsubara frequency, but you're interested in the real frequency approaching zero, coming from the real axis. So what we can do is learn, as Krishna said, learn as much as possible about the spectral function, and see maybe if this gives information to kind of extract the thing which is it's difficult to extract. So just let's just look at what the spectral function actually looks like at high temperature. So it's related to what do this. It's basically see if this ansatz that Kasch and Wout proposed makes any sense, and just let's just calculate it. So let's first look at the scalar theory, where the stress energy tensor is simply this, and this is spectral function. You can write down the one loop expression easily by doing Wick contractions, and it reads like this. There is a spatial derivatives here, spatial case from the derivatives, and then there are two one particle spectral functions from these two lines. It doesn't appear here in this part, actually. It's only the spatial energy momentum tensor. The traceless part of the spatial energy momentum tensor.
Oh.
It's not
the proportional to the energy to the lambda by four times isn't the energy
part. Yeah, but if you look at the traceless parts, it dropped out, I think.
It's proportional to the metric.
Where is lambda in the, but it's not in pi ij, I think.
I think that gives the term that's proportional to the metric. So if you're looking at only the spatial component, the trace is part of that, I guess there's no.
Yeah. I think it just does dropped out, yeah, because I think this is correct.
To the bulk, but not the shear.
Yeah. So now this one particle spectral function should contain the information on the quasi particles in the plasma, and this is very simple. Of course, in the scalar case, there is the plasmon mass from the tadpole, and there is a finite width from the setting sun diagram, which parametrically goes as lambda squared t. This width is very narrow, but it's still essential because there is what is known as a pinch singularity. If you take the external frequency very small, these two particles here, so the two spectral functions here, they approach the real axis at the same point, and this would lead to a pinch singularity, but it is screened by the finite but narrow width. And as a result, the spectral function for very small frequencies goes as omega over gamma, and the viscosity goes as t to the fourth over gamma, or t cubed over lambda squared. This, for the rest of the talk, it turns out then that ladder diagrams are important in this very small frequency region, which was also pointed out by John, because if you add ladder diagram, if you add rungs here, each additional rung adds an additional pinching singularity, which is screened by gamma, and an additional two vertices, which give lambda squared. But since gamma is precisely of this order, each additional rung contributes order one, and you have to sum up this whole series of ladder diagrams. But we are not interested only in the very small frequency behavior, but we basically would like to know the spectral function for all frequencies. And then it turns out it's actually much easier, because this pinching singularity arises from the small frequency limit, and at a finite frequency, these poles are pulled apart, so the pinching singularity goes away, and you can actually take the width to zero, because you can go along the real axis without being pinched by the poles. So the only thing you need to do then is to include a Hartum loop, but it's simple. And for very large frequencies, just a simple leading order calculation is sufficient. So if the frequencies are not too small, you can just do the leading order calculation, and you find a simple expression which corresponds to the decay, to this cutting this diagram, and then the decay into two on-shell particles with equal and opposite momenta. And this contribution also is present at zero temperature, because it's just a zero temperature decay. And this this part of the spectral function just looks like this. So this is rho normalized by omega to the fourth. So for very large frequencies, it goes to a constant. And around t, there is some enhancement because of Bose enhancement. So this is the dashed curve is only the temperature dependent part, so only the part proportional to the to the Bose-Einstein distribution. So that particular contribution goes to zero, obviously, when the frequencies become bigger than the temperature. And around here, you just have zero temperature contribution, basically, and all the temperature physics has gone away exponentially. So now we look at the contribution from small frequencies. Here you have this danger of pinching poles, so you should dress the one particle spectral functions to avoid it. So change them to Breit-Wiechner functions, which have pole in the complex plane with gamma. And in this case, you can also do the integral, and you find a term that the contribution looks like this in this regime. And this you could actually guess from the picture without doing the calculation, because these poles here are pulled apart by omega in the real direction and 2 gamma in the vertical direction. So the distance between these poles is precisely omega squared plus 4 gamma squared, which is written here. And then for very small frequencies, you know that the spectral function should go linear in omega divided by gamma, and that fixes this coefficient here. So this form is, you could guess without doing the calculation, and it's determined by the poles in the complex plane. And actually, for very small gamma, this is becomes a delta function, because gamma divided by omega plus gamma squared is a regularized delta function. So it will give a very a small bump at very small frequencies. So you can calculate this, and you can do the last integral numerically, where we use the full momentum dependence of the width, which was given by Wang and Heinz. And then you get the other thing to notice is that this combination only depends on omega divided by gamma. So the natural parameter is omega divided by gamma and not omega divided by t. So what you get then is a bumpy distribution at very small frequencies. This is an analytic estimate for larger frequencies. And the viscosity then is given by the slope here at very at small frequencies.
That's your spectral function satisfies the sum following from the computation relation.
I couldn't find any useful sum rules, because it's composite operator. So if you go do the usual things to find sum rules, you don't get. Didn't get any easy result for that. I mean,
for single particle
spectral functions, these obey all the standard sum rules, yeah. But for the composite. Yeah, sure. But basically it's a phi squared. So if you take the derivative and so on, it's. I didn't find anything useful, yeah.
This is an analytical model.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here it's very wild around this small Jefferson region where you are interested in omega equals zero. Mm-hmm. So how can you really be sure it
fails
from lattice?
Well, I think that we said already that that's basically very difficult, and I don't think it's really possible. I say, at least if you know, let me show the next transparency. If you know the global shape of this spectral function, you can parameterize it and see what comes out. But I will also not show that. But
so are you going to tell us what Karsh and Weil did?
I can tell you what they did, but they did something really funny, which doesn't compare to this at all. I mean, the answer doesn't look like this at all. But the data was really limited, and the number of free parameters in the fit was comparable to the data points. So I think it doesn't really make sense to discuss this in detail, because it was so rough, say.
Sure, but yeah. you would say that sort of in the, you know, now as opposed to 1987,
yeah.
as more more data comes, more lattice data comes in, you should fit with a form that has this.
Yeah. So what we, so the Japanese people, they are doing larger lattices and they do anisotropic lattices and so on, and they still use this fit formula of Gaussian Wild. So we send them an email to suggest a better fit formula, but they didn't reply. So, but that is that would be the point. Yeah. So if you want to pursue this approach, at least use the correct ansatz for the spectral function. Yeah. So the complete result now looks something like this, and this is not to scale because this particular contribution is actually squeezed against the axis here. So this is a bit blown up. It goes up, then it goes down. It becomes very small here, and then it goes up again, first as omega cube because of Bose enhancement, and then as omega to the fourth. The nice thing, actually, is that these contributions around here from the different processes, so this was a, this is the process of just decay, and this is the scattering because of the finite width. These processes match, the contributions match parametrically here, and it's very small. And then, of course, I did a basically addressed one loop calculations, so you might worry about how higher loops change this particular shape. And it turns out that they will not change it much. So for very small frequencies, I said the ladders are important, but what the ladders do is they change the slope here, but around here there are already the pinching singularities from the ladders are away. So they just change the slope here, but then the overall shape remains the same. And the only other contribution that enters in the same order is this three loop diagram. So it also looks like a ladder, but not the ladder, not the what you would normally call the ladder contribution, but just the cut contribution from decay. Because this, if you calculate, well, first of all, it goes as lambda squared, but if you then calculate it, it actually goes as lambda squared divided by omega. So it goes precisely in the same way as this contribution from the, including the pinching poles. So that will actually will change the coefficient here, but also not the shape. So this shape is pretty, at leading, let's say at leading order in the coupling, this is kind of what a spectral function looks like. Changes the coefficient in that region. Yeah.
Yeah, and the ladder changes the slope.
Changes the slope here. Yeah. And this is high temperature. So no mass. So no, we took the zero temperature mass to zero, and only the Hartum loop induced mass into account. Yeah. Yeah, so I cannot say answers Krishna's question. It's not much blackboard here, but what Kash et al. Did was, this is not visible for people, I guess, but somehow they took, I mean, I don't know why, because it's odd and so on, and they took a peak like this, which peaks at some mass scale and has some width gamma here. So basically, it's a Breit-Wiechner, which is what you would take for a single particle spectral function and not for a composite operator. So it's complete. I mean, even the high frequency behavior is wrong. But I mean, okay, it's. Yeah. So I will come to the lattice correlator later, and the lattice correlator looks like something which looks like this, which you could think is, it looks like an exponential power, and then some changes because of a width. So
presumably they're trying to fit the lower part of your.
No, because this, the peak appeared at normal at temperature, not at small temperatures, not at small frequencies, but the peak appeared at frequencies of the order of the temperature. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, the mass was rather heavy, so it was blue ball like. So all this looks very natural. It's only that it's very remote from all the galaxies here.
Yeah. So you can imprint. So this thing, this parameterization extends to zero frequency. So you have a non-zero slope here, but it has nothing to do with the real problem. But at, you could think at very low temperature, this p- particular composite operator looks like a bound state, and you could describe the correlator of a single particle bound state. But it doesn't make.
I mean, that's what I say. It's like zero temperature. This this depends on room operator. Zero temperature, you know that this is actually the right way to do it. There's some kind of right heat that corresponds to the blue ball.
But at high temperature, it.
Amazingly enough, they seem to be saying that the temperature of the ETC still looks like that.
The question would be, can you define the transport coefficient just above TC in a reasonable way, or will this correlator be completely disturbed by some bound state, which
your curve is for scalar field theory, and this discussion was for QCD.
Yes. So I will come to SUNL. Yeah. Turns out that for SUN it's the same story, but it's a little bit more involved, but not much changes actually. So this is the traces part of the energy, spatial energy momentum tensor. Because it's non-abelian, this contains interactions, and this leads to non-abelian diagrams in this particular calculation. But these are of higher order, so I will not include them, just do the lowest order calculation. Then basically you proceed along the same lines. The propagator is, it's now more involved, so you split it. It has to be split into transversal gluons and longitudinal gluons, and you can introduce the spectral functions for these quantities by using this dispersion relations for single particles. And
is there anything non-abelian about the calculation, or is the calculation like many copies of?
Basically, it's like many copies of the scalar. Yeah.
Many copies of the of a U1 gauge theory.
Many copies of scale. But there is the Landau density. So this single particle spectral function looks different than in just pure 5/4. But it turns out that this is, for practical purposes, it's not really relevant. So it's if you look at the whole frequency domain, at certain particular frequencies, different contributions contribute. But in general, this doesn't change the shape. It's inherently high temperature calculation.
All lattice measurements are done close to TEC.
Yeah, that's true. So
you cannot neglect this diagram because blue ball light reading.
Yeah, so this is, the calculation is at asymptotically high temperatures. So if you now look at this spectral function in the one loop approximation, it looks basically the same, except that one kind of particle, you have transverse gluons and longitudinal transverse and longitudinal, and the vertex from the derivatives here are slightly more involved because you also have time derivatives. And then the single particle spectral functions, they should include the plasma effects, which are in the non-abelian case slightly more complicated, or in the abelian case also. So there is the plasmon, which is the pole contribution, and there is Landau damping, which is the cut contribution. But then if you do the calculation, it's precisely actually like in the scalar case, because for high frequencies, the transverse gluons dominate, and this is precisely the omega. This precisely gives an omega to the fourth times the Bose distribution plus a half, so precisely it's in the scalar case. Then only what is called soft frequencies, GT, it turns out that the pole cut contribution dominates. So this is different as in the scalar case. But it turns out that this contribution is actually already overruled by the kind of hand-waving argument from the pinching poles for transverse gluons. Because this contribution does not include collisions, so does not include a width. So if you look at the pinching pole region, you have to do something else and includes a width, and that contribution there is larger than this pole cut contribution here. So let me show you how this goes, and this actually gives rise to a little puzzle, which was clearly pointed out by Pisarsky, but which was known already. So for small frequencies, you can have a pinch singularity. So you have to include something like the gluon damping rate to screen this pinch singularity, which goes like this. Just an inclusion of this on the one loop level is violates gauge invariance. And it actually means that you have to include the ladder diagrams also. So this is a kind of a heuristic calculation. And then it turns out it's also parametrically wrong, because if you then calculate the viscosity from this one loop calculation, it goes basically as t to the fourth over gamma, but and gamma goes as g squared, so it goes as t cubed over g squared, whereas kinetic theory says that the viscosity goes as t cubed over g to the fourth. So what happens here is kind of special, and it does not happen in the scalar case, and it also does not happen in the case of the color conductivity, that the contributions from the ladder diagrams are actually larger than the one loop result. And as far as I know, this is still an unsolved problem to actually do this calculation in field theory and do a gauge invariant summation of these subclasses of the dominant diagrams to get the same result as that the result that comes from kinetic theory.
You have to go out of the ladder approximation.
So my collaborator did this for a thesis to try to sum up the ladders, and just summing up the ladders did not seem to work. So
by work you mean
agree with kinetic theory and respect gauge invariance.
Yeah. Okay, well,
yeah.
Second is much more serious.
Yeah. And disagree with kinetic theory in the level that there was like 5% difference, so it was not so bad, but
well, there is now this treatment by Pasakoyi.
Yeah. Well, I've been emailing with Jose the last few days, and he says the calculation is not completely satisfactory with this respect. So it's yeah. I believe so. I mean, yeah. But that's an academic problem. That's the unsolved problem. It's an academic problem to just try to calculate this from field theory and not using kinetic theory. Yeah. So if you say I'm interested in the correct result, then you do. Yeah. Well, this is like heuristically this is correct, but the non-abelian case has not been done. Yeah, but for the scalars it has been shown. Yeah. Now it, of course, this is this is. Yeah. In physical terms, it would be. I mean, there is a cancellation, basically, but this is not. I mean,
the question of what the relevant lifetime is that enters the kinetic coefficient is it really this gluon damping rate or some other excitation that's doing the damping? So it's a question of what the right difference is.
Yeah. But this for this particular calculation, it doesn't really matter that much because, well, it matters if you really want to know this curve very well, but it will change the slope here, but the rest of the curve will remain the same. And more importantly for this particular problem, it doesn't affect the Euclidean correlator. So let me show you.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
The slope there is the viscosity. We're actually in the long run.
We want to measure, yeah. We want to know. Yeah.
And if you just said you have physical effect which changes the slope, it's changing the viscosity, and it's not affecting the Euclidean correlator.
Well, but this is the problem we had. I pointed out in the beginning that the Euclidean correlator is only sensitive to the integral over this particular quantity.
So it,
And so, okay. And leading, so it affected in very subleading corrections in G. Yeah. So in the asymptotically high temperature.
So when Karsh and Yaffe were both here, I guess it was during the conference, Karsh showed his spectral function.
I have two transparencies on that.
And Larry pointed out, hey, wait a minute, if you look at that at low frequencies, you're saying that the electric conductivity of the plasma is zero.
Yeah.
And is what you're saying that basically you can't trust the lattice extraction at low frequencies?
Yeah. I emailed with Guy also about it. I have two transparencies on that. I will come to that. Yeah. So the now we can calculate the Euclidean correlator and see what it looks like, because we've now determined the spectral function. So we have to, since we know this one, we can just do the integral. Well, there are two contributions, so let's split it. Let's first look at the high contribution. It turns out that you can do the integral. It looks like a very uninsightful expression, but you can make it very clear by making a little approximation, namely by replacing everywhere the Bose-Einstein distributions by Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, which is turns out to be a very good approximation because it's dominated by very hard frequencies. So it's actually better than 2% for this if you compare these curves. And this particular result is very simple. The correlator basically has a 1 over tau to the fifth dependence, and then it has to be reflection symmetric for t tau going to 1 over t minus tau. So these terms take care of it, and there is another small correction here. So basically, the Euclidean correlator goes as 1 over tau to the fifth. Let me show you that first, because it kind of helps. So that is this particular dot dashed line only. It's basically 1 over tau to the fifth. This is as a function of tau times the temperature, which always lies between 0 and 1. And then it's reflection symmetric, so it's minimal at the central value here. And it's not, there is a non-zero contribution here, which you can calculate. It's some number at this central value, tau is 1 over 2t. So this was just the high contribution. Let's now look at the low contribution around zero frequency. Here you can expand the kernel, and then you can also do the integral. And turns out that maybe quite surprisingly, you get a constant contribution because we expanded the kernel, but the particular value you get is exactly the same as the minimum value you get from the high frequency part of the high frequency part of the spectral function. And as you said, so finer details. So this is in leading order in G, or in lambda, and finer details appear only in subleading terms here. Yeah, they just give you corrections to this integral.
So this constant is dominated by small frequencies, but when you integrate over omega, it comes from the whole range. Sensitivity to the coupling constant, which shows up in the viscosity,
is lost. It's lost.
So you really have to look at how you grow this constant to understand.
So if you put everything together, you get, following Euclidean correlator, there's basically this 1 over tau to the fifth, and then there is a particular constant contribution. And if you put these things together, it looks like this one.
That's the solid curve.
The solid curve, yeah. There is a dashed curve here, also here, but you don't see it. And that is by including the finite mass. This was for the scalar theory. But the mass is subleading in m squared over t squared. So that's really subleading. And you cannot see the difference here between the, well, here you can see the difference between the zero mass analytical formula and the finite mass numerical formula. So the all mass, finite mass effects and plasmon masses is shows up as a very subleading contribution. And
what mass?
This is the plasmon. So in the scalar case, it's lambda t squared.
It's also
In gauge theories, it would be like the GT, say GT. Well, this particular curve for scalar theories. But for gauge theories, it looks the same. Yeah, so this particular the spectral function by itself is finite because it's something like the imaginary part, which is doesn't have divergences. If you then plug it in to calculate Euclidean correlator, you get a divergence when the operators go to the same time point.
It's,
yes, yeah. Yeah, so it's a, what is it called, quintic divergence. And this is, I mean, it goes to infinity. So on the lattice, this is all regularized, and this would be, it goes to some finite points. But then if you make a change the lattice spacing, these points would shift up. Okay, so let me see. Okay, so let me summarize the findings here, which is are kind of negative, unfortunately. So. The spectral function has some characteristic bumpy shape, and then the fit that was used in the literature is completely wrong. And then for the Euclidean correlator, this the problem of getting it there, it turns out, well, the tau dependence of the Euclidean correlator is dominated by basically the uninteresting high frequencies. And this, as I said, the small frequency part just gives a tau independent contribution by an integral. And as a result, the Euclidean correlator is basically insensitive to the transport coefficients. And as far as I can see, it's not really possible to get to extract this from the lattice in a weakly coupled theory. Yeah. Yeah. That's correct, yeah. But. Well, I'm not so sure about that because both curves looks like this. Well, this particular curve I showed also looked like this, and you could say, oh, there is a mass and there's a width, but it's not.
Yeah, his spectral function, which has his bumpy shape, which is his characteristic bumpy shape. Corresponds in Euclidean space to the bowl-shaped thing. So just by seeing a bowl-shaped thing, you don't know that it looks like a mass or a width. It might look like his thing.
Yeah. Same Euclidean correlator on the rough in the rough way. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's the problem. You basically have a global function which looks globally like this, and you can take anything. A Koch is suggestive because you think about some mass.
When you feel lattice becoming exponential, you shout mass, and then there is just the bottom or the well, and you shout width.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, you should look at. You should look at it if you can see the power, because this was a power law. So I looked a little bit at the Japanese data to see if you can actually distinguish that there is a power there, but the data is so rough that it's. No, it's the same. I say you can parameterize this particular bumpy shape with three parameters, and that's and the proposal of Kashinwad was also three parameters, basically a mass width and an overall normalization. So it's the same. So as Krishna said, there is, and Larry pointed out here, there is some relevance for other correlators for what we found. And we thought about this, and then we got an email from a guy who pointed out much more details. So for the thermodilapton rate, you have to calculate basically the imaginary part of the photon polarization. So in terms of the in terms of a spectral function, it's a spectral function of the electromagnetic current in QCD summed over the mu indices. And there was a recent lattice calculation using the maximal entropy method by Kash et al. It turns out that in this case, you also have pinching singularities and a very complicated behavior at very small frequencies. And for the same reason, it's difficult to analyze it on a lattice. In this case, it appears in a tricky way. So if I, instead of looking at the mu mu correlator, let's look at the mu nu correlator. And then the quantity you're interested in is actually minus rho 0, 0 plus rho ii. And I can look at these quantities separately. The rho ii is interesting because it gives the electrical conductivity. So the slope at zero frequency of this particular conductivity gives the electrical spectral function, gives the electrical conductivity in QCD. If you do a one-loop calculation, you find basically the same as we discussed before. You find some, in this case, omega squared behavior, and then a pinching pole contribution, which is, and if you don't include a width, it's a delta function, and if you include a width, it makes a finite slope here, and the slope is the electrical conductivity. If you look at the 0-0 component, it's completely restricted by Watt identities, and if you just do a one-loop calculation, you just find the pinching pole contribution, nothing else. So you find a delta function at zero frequency times omega, surprisingly, but this is so it's a distribution. And this particular result is has to persist to all orders. It's exact, basically. At least the delta function part is exact, because it has to do with charge conservation. Because this 0-0 component at zero spatial momentum is basically the correlator of charges. And the charge is conserved. So in real time, this thing is conserved. So in frequency space, it should be proportional to a quantity like this, always. So what you expect then, if you combine these two contributions for the thermodilapton rates, is that the rho ii should have this kind of bumpy shape with a finite slope, giving the electrical conductivity, whereas the rho 0-0 has something here, but which is strictly at zero frequency. So this is, I mean, you have to add these two things and then try to resolve this. And clearly, this is very difficult. And the results of Kash et al. Is basically that the spectral function vanishes below 3T, so at not asymptotically high temperatures, of course. This is not completely true, because it's a distribution. And we have to, in this particular relation with the, if you go to the Euclidean correlator with this kernel, you have to this kernel here goes as 1 over omega. So you have the kernel goes as 1 over omega, and the spectral function goes as omega times delta omega. So in the end, you just have delta omega to integrate. So it gives a contribution to the Euclidean correlator.
At zero temperature, one of those curves has to have the romance on it, right?
Yeah.
Which one?
It's a bound. It would be bound state of two quarks. Yeah.
Quarks
and the quark. Yeah.
So in thinking about what to fit the lattice data at some key of order TC.
Yeah.
If you use zero temperature as guidance, you're going to fit something with a romance on, mass and width, if you like.
Yeah.
And from high temperature, you're going to fit something that looks like this, which looks totally different.
Yeah. So what Kash and Alf find is they find still something like a little bump around 3T, and then a curve which goes as omega squared. So this omega squared part is suggested by very high temperature, by basically a one loop calculation gives you omega squared. But then somehow, if you would be in very high temperature, the curve simply has to go down. But instead of going down, they find a bump, which would be something, could be something like a Breit-Wiechner, or still something like a loosely bound state or so. So it certainly could be extreme. It could be it's a difficult problem. It could be a mix.
Your bump doesn't look anything like yours.
No. The bump is at much higher frequencies. Yeah, it's not that at small frequency. Basically, below 3T, they find zero, but with an error. I mean, so, but they find zero, yeah.
The point is that those resonances would survive from the low temperature phase have nothing to do with the hydrodynamic behavior of the relaxation that is by male and low frequency. It's just different collective expectations completely. I mean, they may blend in each other as you move temperature, it becomes a very complicated picture, but.
Sure, but I'm thinking much more practically in terms of thinking how to fit the lattice data. I wouldn't think it would be right to use this to fit it, because there should certainly be.
I'm not sure. Very low frequency parts probably look like the high temperature. It's omega compared to T.
Yeah, well, you still expect to have some finite viscosity or finite conductivity above, just not above TC, but close to TC.
Maybe we should ask the lattice people to do the calculation at 100 TC.
Yeah, that would.
Then they should fit to your formula.
That would be yeah.
And I would expect that the slope will change as you reduce T because you're moving spectral weight to these other resonances, but qualitatively.
So
the statement is that as long as the system has electric conductivity, the spectral function should have such a slope, the rho I have such a slope and very small.
Yeah.
Whether you include it or not may not make practical difference in the fit. In the Lachenstein correlator.
You don't see it.
This contribution is wiped out by other stuff like the surviving rho resonance.
Yeah. Just from the theory point of view, there is no, you expect that something is there. And whether you can extract it or not is.
The statement that Larry Yaffe made is that if you do something like that and analyze it, and the result is something that vanishes completely at low, but that is not wrong because it's
put in
the
obvious quality factor. Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah, so that's a technical lattice problem. Okay, in the last 10 minutes, we'll change the subject a little bit and talk about spectral functions in the classical approximation. Well, we heard on Tuesday from Alex that the classical field approximation can be useful since it gives a non-perturbative approach to real-time dynamics of soft, highly populated fields. So you could ask yourself, can we learn anything from classical field theory and looking at spectral functions? And I will give one example that you can learn something. Let's look again at spectral functions. In quantum field theory, well, I now change conventions and I put an I here because that's convenient. Spectral functions are so basically the commutator, and then there's a whole bunch of other correlators, and a particular nice one is a symmetric correlator. So this is the anti-commutator, and these correlators are related by the KMS condition. Like in equilibrium, all correlators can be expressed in terms of the spectral function using varieties of the KMS condition. Now, for classical fields at finite temperature, you can do the same thing. You can look at this classical spectral function, and this is defined by dequantizing the quantum theory. So you replace I times the commutator with the Poisson brackets, and you get the classical expression. Now, this, of course, Poisson brackets look very difficult to compute numerically, but it turns out that also here you have a KMS condition, which makes it easy. So if I write down the normal correlator, so just the autocorrelator between these two observables, there is a classical KMS condition between the correlation function and the spectral function. And in real time, this looks particularly simple. It means that the classical spectral function is just basically the time derivative of the autocorrelation function.
Yeah. What's the frequency corresponds to commutator and
yeah.
anti-commutator? How does it relate to classical
object? Just adding them, so they just commute. So you take the mean, so you anti-commute with a half, and then in the classical theory you just add them. So you don't care about the ordering. It's you could see it as you could see it in two ways. One thing is it should give like an effective theory for the soft modes, so the dynamics of the soft degrees of freedom. Yeah. The other thing is you can just look at it and it defines a field theory where you can do real time dynamics, but you have to put it on a lattice because of the Rayleigh jeans divergence. But then you just have a perfect toy model to investigate real-time stuff.
Excuse me, could you repeat your answer to my question?
Okay, so there are two ways.
Yeah. Let me focus on the problem. So we have correspondence. Commutators, Poisson brackets.
Yes.
Anti-commutators to what?
To just no ordering, just...
simply adding.
Yeah, A times B.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, just simply adding.
Yeah. So as one example where you can learn something about real-time stuff, let's look at the plasmon in a scalar case. So in this case, I look at the one-particle spectral function, so rho is just the commutator between phi, phi. And using this KMS condition, you find that the spectral function is the expectation value of the canonical momentum times the field at unequal times. So it's quite a simple expression. And this you can compute numerically without any problem. So I will show you the results for that. So it's on a lattice discretized. And here's some technical details. The coupling constant can be scaled out because it's a classical theory, so it can be absorbed in the temperature. The temperature comes from the kinetic energy, basically. And then you just do a standard simulation where you make thermal configurations and then do real-time Hamiltonian evolution to calculate observables and then do this many times to get enough statistics. And when you do this, you can calculate the spectral function for this particular one particle correlator. And in real time, it looks like this. So this is the spectral function at zero spatial momentum as a function of time. And it's basically a damped oscillation. So on a log scale, it looks like a straight line. So it's approximately exponentially damped. And this is, of course, the plasmon in this classical field theory. So if you do a Fourier transform, actually a sine transform, you get a very peaked quasi-particle with a narrow width. So this is a function of frequency. And you can fit this quite well with the Breit-Wiechner function, which is shown here. So this is precisely what you would call the plasmon in the quantum case. The scalar theory, yeah. So you can calculate properties of this plasmon in perturbation theory at weak coupling, but you expect this is a general expression with the retarded self-energy. But if the width is very small, you can approximate it with the Breit-Wiechner. I just show this. And then you can actually also calculate the mass and the width in this classical theory. So the mass. It's just a very simple calculation, but it turns out that this is sufficient to understand, in this simple case, everything. So for the mass, you can write down the standard gap equation, but in the classical limit, so there's no Bose distribution here, but just a classical distribution. And for the width, you can calculate the imaginary part of the setting sun diagram, which parametrically looks like this and has a tiny coefficient. And once you've done this calculation, you can compare it with the data and look at the temperature dependence of the plasmon. So this is at three different temperatures, and you see that the peak shifts and the width changes as a function of temperature. And you can compare this with the analytical calculation in perturbation theory. As a function of temperature, this is the plasmon mass, and this is the plasmon width multiplied with 25. And the points are the data points from the simulations with errors, and the lines are the perturbative predictions. And you can see that it matches very well. So in this simple case, perturbation theory is completely applicable. The width has actually a continuum limit. Right. The mass is depends logarithmically on the lattice spacing. It's in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so it's not so severe as in 3 plus 1, but the mass is, but you could put a counter term for the mass. That's easy. And the width is completely, the width has a continuum limit. Okay, so that's it. So I discussed a little bit about transport coefficients, and that, well, the analytical calculation seems to be rather hard, but it turns out also from the lattice it's very difficult, especially to, so it's a generic problem to learn something about very small frequencies, and this is also relevant for other correlators like the thermodileptin rate. And well, all this has to do with basically that you can only calculate in imaginary time, and you really want to know something about real-time correlators. So you can actually, so you, in the last part I showed, you can calculate spectral functions in real time, but then you have to use the classical approximation, and you don't do quantum field dynamics, but you do classical dynamics, and I showed this with the plasmon. Okay, thanks.
Actually, before taking questions from here, I made a reservation at El Paseo for this evening. They asked that we make a reservation for 7:30 rather than 7 o'clock. So I did. So dinner at 7:30 at El Paseo, and so I think we should just meet here. Those of us with cars, bring your cars here at 7 o'clock. Yeah, I'll have little maps. The map questions.
Another enough.
No, how many cars do we have? I mean, we don't need
I think there are about 20 people, so we want 5 cars, I guess.
We have 5 cars.
It looks like we have about 1. Yeah, and actually, if we have. Yeah, that's fine. And some, well, anyway, if it's like when we did this a few weeks ago, after dinner, some people, some drivers will head back here immediately, and some will be interested in staying downtown for longer. Hopefully that will work out. It'll work out one way or the other.
Could you repeat what you have learned from your classical approach? Because you, I mean, how it is your results with classical fields are related to your theoretical results?
So what you learned is that in the simple case, perturbation theory precisely gives the results of, let's say, the non-perturbative simulations, because it's such a simple theory. And so the analytic calculations were done in the, basically in the classical limit of thermal field theory. So you precisely compare the analytical calculation in the correct limit.
Not your last part.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So you basically reproduce classical,
yeah.
Classical fields.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's actually, well, concerning the width, it's already a classical quantity. H bar doesn't really enter there. And concerning the plasmon mass, there is H bar there. So you have to do one particular thing, which is leads to this logarithmic divergence. Yeah.
But that would work for interesting quantities like viscosity, because if you took viscosity, that would be completely dominated.
Yeah.
The
so for transport coefficients, this classical approach would not be very useful because it's dominated by hard frequencies, hard momenta. It would be useful for plasmons in the gate theory case.
Plasmon decay rate.
Yeah.
Plasmon mass, not necessarily.
No, but then you, that would depend on the ladder spacing, but yeah.
So have you tried, or did anybody try, just to use your Euclidean correlator and take a few points and put some noise on that and then use the Mann method? What comes out there?
Yeah, actually we thought of this, but we didn't do this, but this is what the Bielefeld people should do, actually. So what they tested is they tested taking a simple spectral function, which doesn't have any structure at very small frequencies, and then put some noise, precisely what you do, put some noise in it and reconstruct it using the MEM method, and it seems to work very well. But it would be interesting, but I mean, the real test would be to have something non-trivial at small frequencies and then see what comes out. So, but as far as I understand, they have not done this. Yeah.
I mean, also with this conductivity principle, at least the one exercise you can do is obviously they don't say that the slope is zero, but they say that the slope is smaller than something.
Yeah.
And now you can, you know, it's a high temperature conservative prediction, but it ought to be, it must be saying it's, you know, smaller by some factor. Do you ever check what this factor is? Are they violent contradiction, moderate contradiction, or no contradiction?
Well, as far as I understand, is that they did also, they looked separately at the JIJI correlator, which could precisely give spectral function. And then they give the conductivity. And they have to introduce some default model in this spectral, in this maximum entropy method. And apparently, the result, the reconstructed spectral function depends, for very small frequencies, depends on the default model. So you cannot make a unique statement. So I don't think it really makes sense to say something about bounds, because the...
So, but I'm not sure, you know, you put such a clock in the spectrum, but that spectrum is an error bar, right?
Yeah.
May or may not believe that error bar, but so there is a published spectrum and a published error bar, which implies published bound.
In other ways, instead of thinking of bounding the slope, you could think of bounding the height of your little bump.
Yeah, that would, yeah.
A low frequency bump. The question is your entire bump within his error bar.
Yeah. Well, that I actually don't know. Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah.
But, you know, if your bump is smaller than his error bar anyway,
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A low frequency part of the affects his error bars.
Oh, actually, I remember now. It's not so good because they don't plot the spectral function, but they plot the spectral function divided by omega squared, so that the high frequency part is flat. But since the spectral function grows like omega plus omega cubed, etc., if you divide by omega squared, you should actually see a divergence at very small frequencies, and they don't see that. So it's in contradiction in that sense.